Welcome to the Makeup Historian Podcast, interviews that preserve the beauty and blemishes of history. Or in other words, no topic is off limits. I'm your host, Sarah Long, a makeup artist turned historian. But to get started, would you please tell us a little bit about your personal and professional background? So in your professional life, you know, kind of your training, what schools you went to, your research interest, and then on a personal note, how you really started to fall in love with the topic of cosmetic history.
Oh gosh, that's a big question, really. I mean, I live near Edinburgh with my husband, who has MS, and our two dogs. I've got two grown-up children and a granddaughter. School-wise, I went to lots of different schools all over the place because my dad was a bank manager and he kept moving. So lots of places that probably wouldn't perhaps mean anything to people over there, but Edinburgh being one, which is more obvious, but also small fishing villages, etc., I stayed in as well. So I had a bit of a checkered school career, probably not the best. Probably didn't learn much because I kept moving. But I don't know what else I could say about, you know, I don't know. I was quite musical and played the violin and did a lot of dancing and things like that when I was younger. And now I live in a little country cottage, which is very pretty and very relaxing. And I get not a lot of time to do research, but I try to make the most of it. So, and I went to university way back at the end of the 70s, 80s. And I didn't actually do the PhD until the beginning of the 90s and 2000s because I was very lucky I got the opportunity to do this. So many years after I left university. So that was fantastic. The reason I picked the cosmetics and perfumes was because when I was at uni, we didn't really do much in the way of social history. It was all politics and economics. And I had written an essay at one point about social life in ancient Rome and what's like living conditions. And the reaction to that at the time was it was all very interesting, but we don't really do that kind of history. So when I got the opportunity in, which is difficult to explain why I did, but I did, in the 90s to do the PhD. At that time, dress was really popular as a topic. My original degree was in Latin and ancient history, so with a bit of archaeology and classical art thrown in. So I was looking at Romans. Dress was popular, but somehow or other it got narrowed down to cosmetics and perfumes, which hadn't really been done before. I don't know why I picked that. I think I'd always been fascinated by, I remember as a child going to, when we visited the museum in Edinburgh, I would always go and stand in front of the ancient Egyptian hand mirror that was in one of the cases because I was really fascinated by that. And if you want something really, if you want something really quirky, then my birthday is the 22nd of July, which is the same as the feast day of Mary Magdalene, who is the patron saint of perfumes and cosmetics, but I wouldn't go too far with that one. maybe it's just coincidence. So I've always been interested, I think, in appearance and the importance of appearance, how we make snap judgments about appearance quite often. But I had no idea that when I started just how much material I would find.
Yeah, that's amazing. And maybe we can dive into that a little bit more down in the later end of the interview, because I've always been fascinated by that, you know, how you go about the research process and where do you find the sources. And so I'd love to learn more about that. Absolutely. And to kind of continue on what you were saying a moment ago, and this isn't one of the questions I sent you, but do you remember your earliest memory with anything to do with cosmetics?
I think it would have to be that mirror in the museum, really. Mm-hmm. Later on, I remember being at the Vatican and on a tour, and the guide pointing out a mummy that had painted toenails and saying, "This is Helena Rubinstein, 2000 BC or whatever." And these things stuck, I suppose. I don't really know why, but the mirror in the museum always fascinated me. So there you go.
No, that's amazing. And I appreciate that so much. I think one of the things in regards to cosmetic history, right, we're studying items that are not always standing the test of time. So that's why I value these oral history interviews, because those memories, the ones that stick with us, I always find that fascinating. You know, what memories of cosmetics do we keep with us for a long time, and why? And sometimes just saying it and preserving it for future generations to ponder more about, I think is good. Yeah. So for our interview, what I would really love to do is to talk about two of your books. The first one, Painted Faces, or I'm sorry, the full title, A Colorful History of Cosmetics. And I would love to have our first few questions center around that book. And the other few questions I would love to go over are for Common and Uncommon Scents. I believe this is your newest book. I think.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yes.
Perfect. And then just a few conclusion questions. But so we'll dive into talking about Painted Faces first. So the first thing I would really love to know is what inspired you to write that book specifically, and why did you have the scope that you did?
I think it again goes back to the PhD, because the Painted Faces book isn't my first book. The first book I wrote was called Cosmetics and Perfumes in the Roman World, which was based on my PhD. Mm-hmm. But I've always thought that the topic has a much wider appeal than the Cosmetics and Perfumes in the Roman World was very much a sort of academic type of book. And I wanted to bring the fact that cosmetics and perfumes were so important to a wider audience. So that was why I chose to write about cosmetics across the spread of history, cosmetics through the ages, if you like.
And when I was reading it, it was very much so kind of like it was almost like a survey, you know, kind of history book, where I envisioned this as being, it could be used as like the textbook for a cosmetic history class, because it was so good at really giving the fundamentals of the topic. Did you ever have any intention to have this book kind of be the core of a class one day?
No, that would be great if it was. I do know that both books do seem to have an academic audience, which I wasn't really expecting. If you go on WorldCat or one of the library catalogue type things, you can see that it's in the stock of a large number of universities, which is very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've been trying to develop a course about cosmetic history, and if you're okay with it, I would absolutely love to use your book really as that foundational text, because
I would be delighted. Hopefully that means people go out and buy it as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I hope, yeah. But I want to tell you, I enjoyed reading it so much, and it was so helpful, because I actually had your book in my Amazon like cart for a long time, because it wasn't available in the US. I think, when was it? I think it was like maybe 2021. I don't know, but for whatever reason, I couldn't buy it. And I had it sitting in my cart for a long time. And then it finally got shipped and I was so excited. And I'm like, oh, this is such a blessing. I love it. It's so good. Okay. So the next question I have for you, it's a hefty one. So you can do with it what you like or kind of approach it however you like. But what new discoveries have you made about the cultural, political, and religious perspectives of makeup throughout history?
Well, it is a big question. I've learned how important makeup was. People tend to dismiss it as veil or of no great consequence, and I think that's completely wrong. I'm kind of looking at a few notes that I've got here. The close association with health, which was which has come back round again. It was very much the case in the ancient world. And I think that kind of got lost in time, and then now we're coming back to the likes of aromatherapy and things like that. And so we're sort of reinventing old ideas, how we make assumptions about people, about their appearance and what their status is. Kind of things like, for example, whether you believe it or not, beauty spots being used in the sort of 17th century to denote political allegiance. Perhaps a good example. I think it's something that's always been there, and we're inclined to dismiss it as being, as I say, irrelevant. So. And I think the book also draws out the sort of quaint and curious aspects of it as well. You know, the things that, you know, we might want to dismiss and think, oh, that can't be believable. Surely that can't be right. Like, for instance, the mouse brow, using mice to use as eyebrows, and not long ago, somebody in the Science Museum in London identified little brows. So maybe they did use pieces of mouse to stick on their eyebrows. And do we believe some of what's written, or do we not? I mean, we've got a range of evidence as well, which is really, really helpful in the sense that throughout history, there is visual evidence of makeup, but there's also written evidence in lots of different genres, which allows us to sort of even out the bias, if you like, and try and get at the reality. So we've got mention of cosmetics in accounts or legal documents, as well as in poetry or in derogatory religious texts, perhaps. So yeah, it's been a topic that's been well covered by men throughout history, which is another interesting aspect of it.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, that's amazing. And so I'm curious, actually, the question I had sent you was, or the next question I had for you was, in what ways have cosmetics evolved from antiquity to the present day? But as I'm looking at that question, I'm maybe the opposite would be better, you know, and how have they not changed from antiquity into the present day?
Yeah, well, they've not changed in the sense you can still buy the same things in chemists or department stores that the Romans would have used or Egyptians would have used. So things like almond oil or a lanolin face cream, or when it comes to perfumes, things based on roses or whatever. So I mean, obviously there are synthetics and there are a lot more kind of a scientific ingredients that are supposedly in these products now, but we're also going back again to, again, the aromatherapy idea, that natural, organic kind of stuff that. So, yeah, just that we're still using the things that they were using centuries ago, but not the dangerous things like white lead or cinnabar. Although I think possibly in the Far East, some skin whitening products may still be have white lead in them. I think probably by people trying to look more westernized or whatever. But I wouldn't, maybe, I don't know whether I should be quoted on that, because that might be libel, I don't know.
not a problem. We don't have to dive into that one.
Sorry, that's a dog making a noise, not me.
Oh, no, you're totally okay. No worries. Oh, my goodness. Hi, sweetheart. Oh,
yeah. Always excited to join in.
Oh,
there's two of them. That's one of
them. Oh,
no, you so can't sweet. Cry in the middle of this. It's just shooshed. Right. No. Oh, dear.
So sweet. Got to take care of the fur babies. That's awesome. So I'm curious, what type of reactions have you received to the book, whether within academia or by the public? You know, what has been kind of the general reaction?
I think it's been pretty positive, really. As I say, I'm surprised that a lot of universities have bought it and added it to their stock. So that's interesting, which I wasn't expecting. It's had reasonable reviews. It's had good reviews, actually, in good places like the Times Literary Supplement and whatnot. And it seems to have quite a wide reach. It's available in all sorts of different countries. Mm-hmm. Across the world, so that's good as well. And I've done a few talks and things like that. So yeah, I think it's. I think a lot of books are sold online now. So I'm still old-fashioned enough. I would love to just see it on the shelf in a bookshop rather than. Sorry, you might have to edit the squeaky dog.
Oh, no, it's okay.
So. Yeah, it's been, I was on television, which was good because the makeup for that was brilliant. I think it's done well. I mean, there's a huge competition, not necessarily on that particular topic, but just to sell books generally. So, I don't think I can. I'm not making lots of money out of it, but so that's good. So there you go.
Well, I'm incredibly grateful for it because it really is helping to establish this, you know, as a respected discipline. Really, I think cosmetic history is a growing discipline, and you were the one who also told me about the Cosmetic History Network, so thank you so much for that.
Oh, right.
That's amazing. So it's
there's a lot of interesting people on that one.
Absolutely. No, it gives me a lot of hope. You know, I see a lot of amazing future research that will be inspired from your work. It's amazing. And my last question about Painted Faces, what message do you hope readers learn from the book?
That it's a very important subject and can tell us a lot about social, political, and economic history, really. Yeah. That is not to be dismissed. And it's an aspect, I suppose, of dress history, which has become very much to the fore. And there's so much we can learn about a history through approaching it through a social avenue.
Yeah.
I think that's what I think.
Absolutely. I also am curious, are you planning to do any more research or additional books about cosmetic history within the East? Because you kept this one much more focused on the West.
Potentially, it's an idea. Not sure that it's quite my sphere of knowledge, but I'm currently writing, my daughter has a PhD as well, and we are currently writing an article about beauty in Byzantine times
Oh,
for the University of Ghent. However, it's not going very well, I have to say, but so I'm not sure how that one's going to work out. It's a bit sort of stuck at the minute, but it's got a deadline of next month, so I don't know. I think she's doing most of it, but because it's more her sphere of time span anyway, so we'll see. So I suppose that's more Eastern, but yes, that is an idea.
awesome. That would be amazing. Well, I hope the article goes well. I'll be sending good,
Goodbye.
Awesome. Okay, so I want to transition to talk a little bit more about common and uncommon sense. And so for this one, I mean, what was the motivation behind writing this book? And because you do mention that in Painted Faces, that really talking about the history of perfumes, the history of scents, that was going to be a topic that deserved it needed to be a book in itself. So was there anything else that really inspired that motivation for common and uncommon scents?
Excuse me. Well, yes, because it goes back to the original book, The Cosmetics and Perfumes in the Roman World, because perfume was part of the research that I did for my PhD.
Okay.
And I deliberately dropped that particular idea into the first book in the hope that the publisher would pick that up and allow me to. So that was the kind of motivation behind that, really.
I love that. See, those are the things I love to learn about, especially as like I'm in the beginning of my career, and those type of stories are always really fun for me to hear about. So, what do you think is the greatest misconception about the use of perfume throughout history?
Well, one of the things is that I think people assume it's a liquid in a bottle, which is not the case. Not until at least the 17th century. Anyway, it could be a liquid in a bottle, but it could equally be a paste or an oily substance, a semi-solid or a solid substance. And it's also, whereas we associate it, maybe going to a party and put some perfume on or whatever. That's not its original use. It's got far more in the way of religious connotations or medical uses than we would perhaps think of today.
Oh wow, that's fascinating. I love that you shared that. That's such a good point. And that already is inspiring some new research ideas, especially when you said the religious aspect. I'm like, oh, that's something I would love to learn a little bit more about, because I'm making my way through common and uncommon sense. So so th thank you. Thank you for sharing that. What do you believe makes fragrance such a powerful tool in contemporary society?
It's a basic instinct, sense of smell. I mean, back in hunter-gatherer days, we relied on it much more than perhaps we do now, but I think it's been dismissed because it's got these kind of almost animal kind of connotations. I think it's to do with cleanliness and hygiene as well. For us now, we're quite obsessed with cleanliness, and wouldn't have coped with the sort of smells that they would have put up with in the past, like the River Thames being full of sewage, or the Romans having fresh ingredients going off in the sun because they didn't have it in a shop because they didn't have, refrigeration or whatever, and it would be the combined smells of things that you would have encountered in the streets in the past, and it's also about memory. Most people, a smell, a particular smell, can take you right back to perhaps a garden that you didn't in a house that you used to live in, or your grandmother's perfume, or something that is very, very basic instinct.
Oh, I love that. That's such a that's a phenomenal point. And it's so true. Yeah, I have lots of things like that where you'll just, you'll smell something and it takes you back to that childhood memory, something with your grandparents, or that's amazing. To kind of combine the insight on these two books, I'm a little bit more curious about your experience, like the research and the writing process, because I feel like that's something we don't ask scholars enough about. Like, we always love to read the book, the final product, but we don't always get to know about how much work went into it. So when you think about the research process and, all the work that you did for these two books, is there a funny memory, something that a lot of people don't know, or even if it was frustrating or something about that whole process that you wish more people knew about?
Gosh, I don't know, to be honest. I don't think so.
Is it all smooth sailing?
Oh, no, not at all. No. Hard work, and there's always a temptation to disappear down avenues that you can get lost. Well, family life, I suppose, two small children, and when I was doing, not when I was writing the books, they had grown up by that time. My husband was quite ill, so I was doing it against a background of caring and looking after somebody, because he has multiple sclerosis. And I was working, which meant that I had to put quite a lot of effort into it in the evenings. But I suppose it's about commitment, really, a bit the same as the PhD sort of thing. 95% perspiration and 5% inspiration,
Absolutely. Oh my gosh, yeah. So what advice would you give to someone who's interested in exploring the history of cosmetics, even if it's more general, and then maybe even some advice for someone who's really trying to, do their own dissertation or their own thesis regarding cosmetic history?
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't want to give away any ideas I might have for future books.
Don't blame you there.
there's loads of, there's so much to make that point. You just can't overplay that point. There is just so much material. It depends on what you're writing and who you're writing it for as well. You have to write for your audience. So what level are you pitching it at, and who's it for? Is it for an academic audience? I'm seeing that in my book, seems to have crossed the boundaries a bit, but both of them seem to have done that in terms of academic readership or more general readers. Yeah, always make sure you take a note of your references, etc., because there's nothing more frustrating than spending an awfully long time looking for a reference you know you've got somewhere, but you've forgotten to write it down properly or whatever. That's really frustrating. Save things umpteen times and all over the place on pen drives, etc. Don't lose your work. Particularly for the PhD, a case of, you know, have something in the car in case your house goes on fire. Make sure you, because you can't replace all that work. It's very precious, and it's very much yours as well. So just go for it, really.
That's awesome. I really like that. So what do you think more, and this doesn't have to be specific to these two books of yours, but what has been the most memorable moment of your career as a historian?
Right. Well, obviously getting the books published, because it's no to actually get published. There are a couple of things. One of them isn't particularly positive. It's a bit more dramatic than positive. So I'll start with that, because it's maybe if it doesn't sound particularly start with the PhD and say achieving that in the first place was a tremendous achievement, because I did it part time. As I say, family life in the background, etc. The first time I gave a paper, I was on 9/11.
Oh, wow.
In the university in Edinburgh, in Lecture Hall C. And it was to an international audience. It was a conference about colours and antiquity. And I was talking about male faces being, in a Roman painting, being very dark, and women's faces being very pale. And I had not given the paper because I was giving it after the sort of towards the end of the afternoon here. And we broke up for coffee in mid-afternoon, and somebody came on to the stage and said, "There's something happening in America. We don't know what it is. We'll try and get a television, etc., etc." And obviously there was a lot of Americans in the audience. There was a lot of people from all different countries. So we had our coffee break and got back onto the stage, and it was my turn to give this talk. And the person who was in the chair said, "Look, we don't know what's happening, really. We're just going to keep going as we did." So I gave the paper, but I think most people were on their mobile phones by this time. When I came out, it was a big moment for me because, or would have been, because I'd never given an academic paper before. But when my husband was going to meet me, and when I came out of the lecture hall, of course, instead of saying what we would have expected him to say, which was, "How did your paper go?" he just went, "Have you seen the news?" So we all just stood there and watched pictures on the television, more or less in silence. So it was, most people probably remember where they were, but yeah, it's it was a difficult one. With the audience was very mixed, and their reactions to it, we weren't very sure how they would react, and it was obviously very distressing for a lot of people. Anyway, on a more positive note, yes, and when I did the PhD at my Viva, I was asked by the examiner if I would like to accompany them to Berlin to a conference there. Can you hear me? Yes?
Yeah, everything sounds great.
Yeah, okay. So I went to Berlin and stayed in the poshest hotel that I've ever stayed in. My husband and I went on a little holiday while we were there. And I gave a paper at Humboldt University, where Einstein taught. So that was quite a...
That's phenomenal.
And so I wasn't expecting to be, because the examiner and the people that I went with were quite important. And that, well, I'm not particularly important anyway, but I mean that was a great honor. So
definitely, what a phenomenal story! Yes, oh my gosh, what an honor! I wouldn't even know what to do. That'd be so cool. Oh, I love that. Well, I want to say thank you so much, Dr. Stewart, for taking time out of your schedule to speak with me and share with me more about your books and the process behind creating them. It really is such an honor. And you are absolutely always welcome here anytime that you want to talk about anything, really. I mean, it would be my absolute honor to always have you back on the show. But I really just, yeah, thank you. You've helped make the whole research process a lot better and more fun. And like I mentioned earlier, I would totally love to use your books in courses one day. And I hope I have your blessing to do so.
Oh, absolutely. I would be delighted for you to do that. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much.